You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Pictures of the slain sons of Saddam Hussein have circulated around the world. In an exclusive interview with the Times of London, the bodyguard of Uday Hussein spoke out for the first time, claiming that Saddam Hussein and his sons did not flee Baghdad during the bombing, but rather held out in the capital for at least a week after its fall. He said that they evaded repeated American attempts to assassinate or capture them and even appeared in public under the noses of U.S. troops. The bodyguard told the newspaper that Saddam suspected an informant in his camp when the Americans' so-called decapitation strikes began hitting closer to the safe houses in which Saddam was hiding. Saddam then directed the suspected captain to set up a safe house behind a restaurant in the Mansour district for a meeting. Saddam and company arrived and went immediately out the back door. 10 minutes later, the house was bombed. Saddam had the captain he suspected summarily executed while the Pentagon was claiming the strike had killed Saddam and his son Uday. Meanwhile, the questions of whether the Bush administration overstated the threat posed by Saddam to mislead the country into launching the brutal campaign of shock and awe against the people of Iraq continues. In an article in the New Republic magazine, Spencer Ackerman and John B. Judas wrote, quote, "Foreign policy is always difficult in a democracy. Democracy requires openness, yet foreign policy requires a level of secrecy that frees it from oversight and exposes it to abuse," end quote. Peace Watch sat down with Assistant Editor Spencer Ackerman earlier this week and asked him to talk about this principle in the context of the post-September 11th world that we now live in and the trust that the American people placed in Bush when he used confidential intelligence info to justify the war in Iraq.
It's a difficult position for any open society to be in when facing an imminent danger or a danger that materializes as it did so horribly on September 11th. National security information is classified for a reason. There are certain aspects of information that we simply, as citizens, can't know about for various reasons of safety and security. Nevertheless, our political system requires us as citizens to make decisions based on as much information as possible. And so skirting that balance is incredibly difficult, particularly in a time of terror. And without vigilant guardianship, and an appropriate respect for that balance, the system opens itself up for abuse. And I believe that it's one of the most important principles that needs to be upheld to make sure that abuse doesn't happen. And in the post-September 11th world, it's not just going to be an issue for this president on this issue of Iraq or al-Qaeda for that matter. It's going to be an issue for every subsequent administration that faces a threat like we do from al-Qaeda.
Is it your opinion that the Bush administration actually abused that power?
I think the evidence that we know of so far makes a decent prima facie case that there was abuse from the White House and from the Defense Department. How deep it ran, we don't quite know yet. How serious it is, we don't quite know yet. But with some of the reporting that we did, we talked to various officials in the intelligence community, and we came away convinced that whether there was intentional abuse that went forward, perhaps that wasn't the case, although it remains to be seen. But certainly some of the intelligence analysts felt that they were being pressured to make their reports fit a preconceived policy.
Mm-hmm. So in light of these recent admissions that we're hearing from the White House, would you say that our intelligence agencies were insulated from political interference in the lead up to the war?
It seems to be that insulation is somewhat of a platonic ideal of how political appointees in various agencies and elements of the executive branch should interface with the intelligence community. And that insulation appears to have been broken down.
Mm-hmm. In fact, you claim that the administration ignored and even suppressed disagreement within the intelligence agencies and pressured the CIA to reaffirm the administration's preferred version of the threat that Iraq supposedly presented. What's the basis of your assertion for that?
There are several different elements of that. To take just one example that's come to light recently, the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research during the spring and the summer of 2002 was asked to assess, as were the rest of the intelligence community, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the Central Intelligence Agency, what precisely the threat was from Saddam Hussein's reconstituted or allegedly reconstituted nuclear weapons program. And there were a few pieces of intelligence data that the intelligence communities had collected, perhaps most infamously now, accusations of alleged procurements of uranium, mm-hmm. yellowcake from Niger, and alleged shipments of aluminum tubes for perhaps a reconstituted nuclear weapons program. And when INR, as the Bureau of Intelligence and Research is known, talked with the experts within the U.S. intelligence community, particularly Department of Energy nuclear scientists, and assessed the actual evidence that we had of these aluminum tube shipments coming into Iraq, what they came to find was that these tubes were not suitable for a nuclear weapons program, and they would have to be doctored in various technical ways in order to enrich uranium in what's called a cascade enrichment. And so they came to the conclusion that this was simply not evidence of a nuclear weapons program. And the more they brought that view forward in various closed-door meetings last spring and last summer, more and more they faced resistance from higher and higher level officials in the CIA who were rather convinced that the intelligence simply showed that these aluminum tubes were only for a nuclear weapons program, which was an accusation that Condoleezza Rice made on television, the National Security Advisor, in September of 2002. And so quickly, over the course of these next several weeks, it became clear that INR and the more expert intelligence analysts on the nuclear issue had a view that was becoming more and more marginalized. And when ultimately the National Intelligence Estimate was written over the course of a couple weeks in September and eventually published in a declassified form in October, the INR's position, which was also, I should add, the position of some other intelligence analysts in the CIA and DIA, mm-hmm. became more and more of a marginalized position until it became ultimately, as newly declassified elements of that NIE, which were made public on Friday, reveal, it was simply relegated to a footnote in a larger case. And that case was stated with very little equivocation and very little balance, that these tubes simply, as a matter of intelligence, indicated nothing else but the existence of a reconstituted nuclear weapons program. Mm-hmm. And that's something that happens on a variety of issues in the CIA, on the links between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, on other elements, as we're finding out with the Niger yellowcake uranium, which ended up in the president's State of the Union. And on and on and on, these issues appeared both within the intelligence community and in the intelligence community's presentation to Congress and in the administration's presentation to the public. Mm-hmm. Doubts were sort of written out of existence in public presentation, and sketchy intelligence became translated into certainty, as the president would constantly say and his lieutenants would constantly say. These are things we know. These are things that intelligence clearly shows.
Mm-hmm. Abuse of the power.
I think you can make a strong case, based on what we know right now, that mm-hmm. the process simply broke down.
In deflecting criticism over the inaccurate statements Bush made concerning Iraq's supposed attempts to obtain uranium from Africa, the White House has repeatedly said that these were just simply 16 words out of the entire State of the Union address, and that the case for war was built on much more than this single point alone. How significant was this, in your opinion?
I think it was ultimately very significant for two reasons. One, the 16 words indicate part of a broader pattern of how the administration translated uncertainty, ambiguity, unclear information, information that could be interpreted to fit an alternative theory, into certainty to the public. I think that's primarily one of the reasons that this issue simply doesn't go away for the White House, and nor do I think will it over the course of the next several weeks. But there's another reason this is significant, and that is simply substantively on the case for war. We were told repeatedly over the last year that Iraq presented a grave and gathering threat to American security. And what I would say would be the most compelling aspect of that case would be the prospect of a madman, a mass murderer, someone who has committed genocide, someone who has invaded his neighbors twice on two different occasions, that is, possessing the world's most dangerous weapons, those being nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. And what the National Intelligence Estimate said in October, and as the president said in his State of the Union speech, and was the case that he made as well in October of 2002 in Cincinnati and his administration made in other fora, if Iraq acquired fissile material from abroad, then the National Intelligence Estimate said, we would see a case where Saddam Hussein would have a nuclear weapon in about a year. Mm-hmm. And that presents an imminent security risk to the United States. And so basically the administration puts out the line that this was part and parcel of a broader picture, which is true. We also heard much discussion about Saddam Hussein's chemical and biological weapons programs, as well as human rights abuses, his record of aggression, which is undeniable. But I would say when the administration needed to present the case for war as being an issue that the United States needed to deal with immediately, the nuclear weapons case was more or less front and center. Mm-hmm. And in that case, the administration placed the prospect of Saddam acquiring uranium from Africa at the center of that.
Now, a great deal has been made out of the fact that the National Intelligence Estimate, prepared for Congress by the CIA, included the language about the uranium from Africa, even though it had been discredited. And I was kind of intrigued by the implications that the CIA and the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, were pressured by the administration to include these qualified statements in the classified report presented to the Congressional Intelligence Committee. You've talked a little bit about that already. I just want a brief outline of that process and what the differences were in the two reports that misled the Congress over the real threat posed by Saddam Hussein.
Well, what seems to have happened over the course of the last year with the CIA is that analysts at Langley, the CIA's headquarters, started getting visits from very senior White House officials, including Vice President Dick Cheney, his chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby, and others in the administration. And this is not something that happens very routinely. It's not unprecedented, I should say that, but it is not a regular occurrence. The president and the vice president receive intelligence briefings every morning. To have the vice president and his top aides visit very low-level analysts at Langley is not something that, as our sources have told to us, something that analysts deal with very well. It simply becomes whether the vice president makes it plain. I doubt he would, and it may in fact not even have been his intention, although it remains to be seen. But certainly the analysts, many of them, and certain officials in the CIA got the message that the White House was looking for a given interpretation in the intelligence that it was receiving.
Dick Cheney visited these low-level analysts how frequently?
It's not clear yet, but there were several visits that occurred in the summer of 2002 to Langley that Cheney or his chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby, undertook. Mm-hmm. The extent to which still remains to be seen.
And he actually spoke to the analyst?
Directly, yes.
Directly. Is there any record of what was said?
Not yet, no. That still remains to be seen.
But even something like that, while unusual and inappropriate perhaps, has it stepped over any line of protocol or propriety or legalities?
Right. You're right to point out that it's not unprecedented. These visits have happened by senior administration officials in other administrations in the past. They're not without precedent. However, on an issue as sensitive as this, and on any issue for that matter, the CIA institutionally has a culture of independence that it seeks to create something of a firewall between political actors in any administration and its analysts in order to preserve what it seeks to present, which is the integrity of intelligence uncolored by political considerations. And simply put, I don't believe these analysts and these CIA officials would be talking to the press about the extent of these visits if they did not feel that these visits were intended to sway the analysts in one way or another on given issues regarding Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Dick Cheney was among those in the administration that wanted to move forward with the invasion of
That's
Iraq.
That's true.
Whereas you had the State Department and Colin Powell choosing a more moderate path, quote unquote.
I think that's largely true, although the extent to which that's true is somewhat, I think, a bit of a caricature or an oversimplification. Secretary Powell, I happen to know, received a memo in March 2002 from the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research telling him, by the way, the Bureau of Intelligence and Research exists primarily as part of the intelligence community to provide the Secretary of State with information.
Mm-hmm.
The Bureau of Intelligence and Research sent Secretary Powell a memo in May 2002 informing him of the doubts that the Bureau had about whether Iraq was really acquiring uranium from Niger. And yet this information, 10 months later, appears in a State Department press release in a fact sheet that they present in late December 2002 about Iraq's weapons declaration that it gave on December 5th, that you'll recall the 12,000-page declaration about its weapons programs. The State Department released a sheet saying more or less, what is Saddam Hussein hiding by not disclosing his uranium purchases from Africa? So while it is true that the State Department pursued a more internationalist path toward the war, the difference may or may not be as great as some in the media have made it out to be.
At the same time, however, Colin Powell did delete that reference in the address that he was to give before the United Nations, the reference to Saddam Hussein attempting to acquire uranium from Niger.
Indeed, he did, although he's never answered questions about how it could be that he received a memorandum in March of last year.
And it still showed up.
And it still shows up in a subsequent release that his department put out. But indeed, you're right. He did delete quite a bit of what he considered to be questionable intelligence from his February 5th presentation to the United Nations Security Council.
And so now we're hearing where Condoleezza Rice is taking responsibility for that statement. What do you make of that?
I saw her top deputy, Stephen Hadley, made a very startling admission in an impromptu briefing, I believe it was, that he had received memorandum from the CIA on October 5th and 6th, the days before the president's statement outlining the case for a war in Cincinnati of last year, telling him that the CIA did not have confidence in a line that the president was to deliver about a shipment of 500 tons, I could be wrong about that, of yellow cake from Niger. And subsequently, Hadley received a phone call from CIA Director George Tenet imploring him to strike the line, as ultimately Hadley did or made sure happened. And in fact, on July 11th, when Rice was aboard Air Force One en route to Entebbe in Uganda, she gave a rather combative briefing to the press corps informing them that the CIA delivered to the administration a national intelligence estimate that we talked about that said, and she said no less than five times that the CIA, mentioned uranium from other places in Africa going to Iraq, and repeatedly emphasized that no one in the White House had known about the doubts that the CIA had about this intelligence. And that was, you'll recall, the briefing where she called out Director Tenet personally to take responsibility. So over the next couple of days, I would expect that the National Security Advisor will be under quite a bit of pressure to see if she will take responsibility as her top deputy has, or whether the fact that her deputy, Stephen Hadley, has taken responsibility means that Condoleezza Rice will not. However, Hadley mentioned in his briefing that one of the memos he received, I believe it was the October 6th memorandum, was also addressed to National Security Advisor Rice.
And of course, CIA Director George Tenet initially took partial responsibility for this line ending up in the president's State of the Union address.
That he did.
What kind of effect does all of this have on the Bush administration's credibility, in your opinion?
Well, I think now George Bush's greatest political asset was the fact that he's painted himself quite successfully up to this point as the opposite of his predecessor, that he is not someone who parses words legalistically and carefully. He will present the unvarnished truth to the American people. Sometimes it'll get him into trouble for doing that, as it has on several occasions, like when he implored Iraqi guerrillas to bring him on, meaning attacks on American forces. And this appears to undercut that very significant political asset that he's held. Over the past 60 days, polling data has shown that he's gone from still being perceived as a wartime president with approval ratings in the high 60s and the low 70s to dipping down into the mid 50s, which is an astonishing drop in public credibility over the past 2 months alone. And it appears to have picked up steam over these last several weeks the flap over Niger uranium has come to light. So it is presenting, although it is somewhat premature, a serious political problem to the Bush administration.
So you think that heretofore he was perceived as, you know, just kind of a straight-talking cowboy?
I think that's generally the perception that he sought to cultivate.
Mm-hmm. And so your article appeared in The New Republic. What kind of response have you received? And do many observers and academics on the right, as well as members of the Bush's own Republican Party that you've spoken with, do they share your concerns?
Well, we've had some articles that have come out, principally from right-wing publications, from conservative publications, I should probably say, that have taken exception to some of the things we've published, that have tried to refute the article on various substantive grounds. And so it appears to have, as was our intention, sparked a debate about the issues that our reporting raised. And so I think that's a positive thing. What I haven't seen from the right wing, especially from those who would advocate a preemptive security policy, and I would count myself as one who would argue that sometimes preemptive military action is warranted and necessary, mm-hmm. For the protection of American security. An implication in our piece is that if the president's credibility, if the administration's credibility because of this issue is diminished, then it will be increasingly hard for future situations which may indeed require preventive military action. To take two examples, perhaps a nuclear Iran or perhaps a nuclear North Korea, perhaps as well the prospect of a nuclear Pakistan falling into the hands mm-hmm. of anti-American Islamists. There will be situations perhaps in the future that may warrant preemptive military action, and I would think that those primarily on the right who have advocated such a security doctrine for the past several years would want this issue laid to rest in as open and as public a manner. Otherwise, it risks undermining the very bases, meaning intelligence, mm-hmm. for taking preventive military action.
Let's back up a little bit to September 11th again. We talked about that earlier. After September 11th, 2001, the administration claimed repeatedly that Saddam Hussein had ties to al-Qaeda. Secretary of State Colin Powell mentioned that there was evidence of conversations between the Hussein regime and al-Qaeda going back as long as a decade. What did your research uncover regarding al-Qaeda ties to Iraq, if anything?
That intelligence analysts working on the issue increasingly over the past year or so were not really able to come up with what Donald Rumsfeld called in September bulletproof evidence linking Saddam Hussein to Osama bin Laden. In fact, much of what the president used to source his public statements about a link between al-Qaeda and Iraq were testimonials from some of the al-Qaeda and Taliban that we have in custody in Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere. But more senior al-Qaeda lieutenants, for instance, Ramzi bin al-Shaib, who was captured in September in Pakistan, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the architect of September 11th, and Abu Zubaydah, who we captured, I believe, in the spring of 2002, have all contradicted that line. And so it's strange to note, and it hasn't really been noted yet by the administration, that the bases for these statements, like I said, Donald Rumsfeld had argued that there were bulletproof evidence linking mm-hmm. Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. This evidence doesn't seem to have been materialized. It seems to have been contradicted in a variety of instances. And analysts who worked on the issue for several years aver that there is no such link, certainly not to the degree that the administration has claimed. I don't think the book is closed on this issue yet. I think there probably is quite a lot more that we have to find out about. But I also think that rummaging through the intelligence directorate's files in Baghdad, you could probably discover quite a bit about this relationship. And it strikes me as strange that an administration that's on the defensive about issues in intelligence that it mm-hmm. perhaps has not been quite so forthright about would not have held very frequent and very high-profile briefings to demonstrate any links that it would have subsequently found.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, speaking before Congress and in a meeting with President Bush, British Prime Minister Tony Blair said that even in the worst case scenario, if weapons are never found in Iraq and the U.S. and U.K. turn out to be wrong, history will understand that they still did the right thing for removing a brutal dictator. What's your reaction to that?
Frankly, I agree with Prime Minister Blair. We've known for about 20 years now, the perfidies of Saddam Hussein. This is a genocidal dictator, and I make no apologies for the fact that the United States and Britain overthrew him. And what ultimately the Prime Minister's statements should mean is that what history will not judge with any exculpation, perhaps, is whether the United States and Britain don't follow through on their commitments to engender a rebirth of Iraq as a free and democratic society.
Mm. So you support the overthrow of a brutal dictator in another country. You don't support that the people of Iraq should be allowed to run their country, to have a sovereign nation, and to, if there's a brutal dictator there, they should be allowed to overthrow him.
Well, I certainly believe that Iraq ought to be a situation where its own internal political dissent is expressed in a way that would have overthrown the Saddam Hussein regime. But this was simply not a situation where that could have occurred. Saddam Hussein ran what the Iraqi dissident Kenan Makiya rather eloquently called a republic of fear, which ruled in perfect totalitarian fashion by making its enemies complicit in its crimes through a variety of rather revolting and horrifying mechanisms, most importantly its multifaceted state intelligence and secret police organizations. So whereas in an ideal world, outside military intervention would not have been necessary to destroy such a monstrous regime, in this case, I really don't see how any other alternative could have deposed Saddam Hussein, and for that matter, led to a situation in which Saddam Hussein did not pass on his disgusting legacy to his two genocidal and megalomaniacal sons, Uday and Qusay, who were killed in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, there were other nations around the world that felt that the UN inspection process should have been given a chance to play itself out, and that a preemptive strike, which was used in this case, was not necessary. The UN inspectors took a beating, in fact, in the U.S. press, and according to The New Republic, Cheney assaulted the International Atomic Energy Agency, saying, if you look at the track record of the IAEA, they have consistently underestimated or missed what it was Saddam Hussein was doing, end quote. Cheney referred to the actions of Hussein prior to the Gulf War. Please explain how this statement mischaracterized the facts in terms of the IAEA's role prior to the Gulf War.
What I would say about Dick Cheney's rather striking public statements that was on Meet the Press in mid-March, a few days before the war started, he assaulted the credibility of the International Atomic Energy Agency, and he in particular assaulted the credibility of its Director General, Mohammed Al-Baradei. However, for the past several months, the IAEA had informed through various channels the United States and the British governments that it was finding on the ground in Iraq a far different picture than what the United States and Britain presented of a reconstituted nuclear weapons program. And rather forthrightly, it did not surprise the U.S. or the U.K. with this information. It briefed them through various channels about what it was fun. Perhaps brief is not the right word, but it made clear to the U.S. and the U.K. that the facts on the ground were not what the U.S. and U.K. were describing, mm-hmm. nor was the intelligence that the U.S. and U.K. giving to the IAEA of the sort of credibility that you would normally expect from a high-level administration argument. For instance, Jacques Bout, the chief IAEA inspector in Iraq, used the search engine Google to determine the fraudulence of some of these documents that seemed to indicate Iraq was trying to procure large amounts of yellowcake uranium from Niger. And they allowed for the U.S. and U.K. to know what they were finding. And repeatedly, they said, if we are missing something, if there is more information, if we're simply going about this in a way that perhaps doesn't make much sense, what can you tell us that would disabuse us of these perhaps mistakes? Mm-hmm. And again, the message came back that there was no more information that would be shared about this. And in the case of the Niger uranium forgeries, the U.S. and U.K. informed the IAEA that not only were they not contesting the IAEA's interpretation, but that there was no separate intelligence that the U.S. or U.K. had, which is much different from what the British government is now saying. So for Dick Cheney to say in public something that completely contradicted what his government's officials were telling the IAEA in private is quite astonishing.
Spencer Ackerman, assistant editor of The New Republic and co-author with John B. Judas of the article The First Casualty that appeared in the June 30th issue of the magazine. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Palmer of KPFA and Keith Chalgian. Thanks to Pete Karak at RadioForAll.net and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. It's your financial support that makes Peace Watch possible, so we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at Pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. You can also visit webactive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.